All right, we might kick off. Just by way of brief introduction, my name's Alistair Barker, work at Australian Super, and I'll be your chair for this afternoon. So, look, we're very fortunate to have three panel members here to my immediate right to run through this session today. Hopefully you'll find it a useful and interactive discussion. As it says up here, the topic for the day is actuaries in investing and asset management. Opportunities to increase our influence and add value. So the purpose here is, and what I've challenged each of the speakers to do, is spend 5 to 10 minutes talking about one specific issue each, around areas where we think the Institute needs to take more of a leadership position, areas where we think the actuarial skills can add more value. The first person who will talk is Ian Patrick, who to a certain degree needs no introduction, but for those of you who aren't aware, is the current CEO of JANA and has been there since 2002. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree and an MBA from the University of, and I'll definitely pronounce this wrong, Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, and he's a qualified fellow and faculty of the Institute of Actuaries. He's also a CFA charter holder, so has some useful perspective holding that separate designation as well. Ian will briefly talk about the current investment environment and some of the challenges that he and his colleagues are seeing at JANA. Next, we'll hear from Chris Condon. Chris, most of you who we will know, was up until a number of years ago running the investment team at MLC, over $60 billion in assets under management, and has been in the investment industry for best part of 30 to 40 years by the looks of his CV here. So certainly a great guy, always willing to call it how he sees it. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about some of the thinking that he's been doing in the post-retirement phase. And I look forward to that. And finally, Susan Roberts is the Managing Director and CEO of Lazard Asset Management Asia Pacific. Again, over 20 years of investment experience, holds a Bachelor of Economics from Macquarie University and is also a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and a Director of Women in Super. She'll talk about some of the issues from her standpoint as someone in the active management space and also, you know, what can be done more by actuaries in that area. So each of them will speak for 5 to 10 minutes. We'll then have the opportunity for some Q&A around each of these particular issues. Looking forward to some interesting questions. And we'll take it from there. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Ian.
Thanks, Alistair, and good afternoon, everybody. At one level, I'm particularly challenged by Alistair's comment that this requires some insight as to how the profession can help in the investment arena, because for those of you who know JANA, you'll understand that an actuary was barely tolerated in JANA for much of my time there. And that's because, but it's important to sort of put that in some context, that is because the firm is largely market-driven in its approach to asset allocation, in its approach to all investment matters. And I think if from that the lesson I take for the profession is that, in my view, in investment markets, it's a very neat balancing act between the statistics and the models and the market intuition, and treading the line between the two, and probably more importantly, being able to communicate across that specific chasm sometimes between the model and the statistics and the market reality is the value that we can bring, because if anything, there should be quality insight from the profession via thorough analysis, and at the end of the day, that's the most, in my view, actuaries can hope to bring to the investment sphere. Anyway, talking more specifically to the question posed by Alistair, what do we see in the market environment? There's nothing that I would say that would come as a particular surprise. When we think about it, we think about three things: valuation, fundamentals, and sentiment. If I'm to give you my headlines now, the major risk in markets is a valuation risk. That is probably been brought about by improving fundamentals, which have driven strong sentiment, which have resulted in equity markets, in fact all risky assets, appreciating markedly. One only has to think of the environment in which we find ourselves with negative real cash rates throughout the developed world, bar that sell-off in bonds last year. We would have had negative bond rates, long bond rates around the world, and that's particularly problematic for any investor wishing to invest over the long term, because you buy a bond today, albeit at a marginally positive real return, you're locking in extremely low returns for the long term. So what have investors done? By and large, they've eschewed that problematic reward equation and gone after risky assets. And as I said a moment ago, that's been aided by the fact that fundamentals have looked stronger. The threat of deflation has dissipated. We're facing into a period of what looks like fairly decent synchronized global growth. And profit margins until 2 years ago, let's say, were looking particularly healthy or had rebounded particularly strongly post the GFC. And all of that drove sentiment towards risky assets. And so we've had broadly positive fundamentals, broadly positive sentiment, and valuations have gone up. Now, at the end of the day, valuations don't look hugely expensive. PEs, other than possibly Australia and the US, don't look exceedingly expensive, and in Europe, some pockets probably marginally cheap. And so why would I say the threat is a valuation threat? Well, the main reason I say that is that in the equity sphere particularly, earnings have plateaued over the last 2 years. EPS throughout the developed world has been flat on an aggregate basis. And so what you've had is escalating valuations, but no fundamental support through growing earnings. And unless earnings come through to support these elevated levels of valuation, I think there's the first threat. The other threats are around discount rates. At some point, one anticipates that monetary easing will be reduced. At that point, discount rates will go up, and one can imagine an impact from a valuation perspective at that point. I want to turn very briefly before closing to valuations of property and infrastructure, because those have gotten a fair bit of attention more recently. I think it's the valuations in those two asset classes have been a mirror of what we've seen in equities. In the pursuit of higher levels of return, all risk assets have been highly sought after, including property and infrastructure. In those cases, it's probably been acute in Australia because we have a mature market in both those asset classes with well-established players, both from the delivery of the assets through to the investment in those assets. And so cashed up investors globally looking for, with low levels of interest rates at which to borrow, have been able to bring sizable chunks of capital to this market and other property and infrastructure markets, and that has bid up prices. And a consequence of all of that, whether it's bid up prices in property and infrastructure, whether it's bid up prices in equities, is fundamentally we're looking at a low return environment or a lower return environment going forward. It is very difficult to paint the upside scenario that demonstrates very strong global growth, growth in incomes, growth in profitability, growth in investment, which has lagged, as an aside, to support asset prices at these levels and drive incremental returns that are of the order of 5 or 6 years ago. So I think we are looking at a low return environment. I'll take anything further in questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks to the Institute of Actuaries for asking me to come and give me a soapbox. I love getting on soapboxes. I want to talk about how actuaries can show some more leadership in the retirement income space. And I have three suggestions. First of all, we should be incorporating investment risk in our models, in our policy statements as an institute, in our responses to government policy. And we fail to do that, I think, more often than not. The second thing is that we need, as a profession, to stop being a cheerleader for product providers. Now, individual actuaries that work for product providers, fine, but the profession has become a cheerleader for product providers, and I'll explain what I mean by that. And thirdly, we need to face into this area of low interest rates, which is just touches on some of the comments that Ian was making. So first of all, what do I mean by incorporating investment risk into models and policy statements? Well, first of all, I want to say that investment risk is not the volatility of the rate of return on an investment. In the retirement income space, I think we can define investment risk much clearer than that. And in other spaces you could as well, but I'm just focusing on that. And I would define it as the risk that as an individual, as a family, you won't achieve your reasonable retirement expectations, aspirations. In other words, put it in actuary speak, the first moment of the return distribution is often more important than the second moment of the return distribution. If you're not getting the returns, it doesn't matter how low a risk you've got, you're just not going to generate the retirement income that you need. And I think this is where actuaries really can show some leadership. If we define investment risk as not meeting retirement aspirations, then we need to be able to work with both assets and liabilities. And that's something that most investment professionals avoid. CFAs, who aren't actuaries, generally hate that because it's too hard. And yet this is something that we are trained in as a profession, and we really need to be, and nobody is going to take this up and really run with this if it's not us. But the investment professionals have dominated this space. They've captured the lingo. They have, every time I see investment risk in almost any investment publication or academic journal, almost always it means the volatility of a rate of return. And we just don't have to be sucked into that. Now, there's been a number of battles along this line that I think we've got some pretty poor, as an institute, some pretty poor scores on. And the first one is this horrendous measure that the superannuation industry has called the standard risk measure. And for those that aren't in the industry, it's the number of years in 20 that a strategy will generate a negative nominal rate of return. Now, it's very easy to demonstrate in many, maybe most cases, that this risk measure will give perverse results if you compare it to a risk measure based on what I suggest it should be, which is the risk of not achieving retirement income expectations. Strategies with low SRMs will often fail to generate decent retirement income, whereas strategies with higher SRMs will often deliver. Now, because the Institute, I think, was on the right side there, but it failed. It didn't actually achieve, from my understanding, it put the case forward and it failed in that space. It's one thing for the Institute not to be heard, but it's another thing for it to be complicit in the development of poor policy, and I think I'll give you an example of that. In March last year, ASIC put out a consultation paper 203. It might be 230. I think that might be a transmission. Anyway, it related to the Class Order 11-1227, which specifies that you need to use 3% deterministic model, very, very prescribed if you're going to ask for an exemption from needing AFSL advice rules if you're a superannuation fund to make projections of retirement income. Now, the actuary's response to this was just tinkering with the words and a couple of the little things. It profoundly failed to state that the massive issue associated with this whole approach was that it often leads to because it's a deterministic approach, it'll often lead to misleading information to members. I would suggest that every institute pronouncement in superannuation retirement space where it's relevant, should insist on stochastic an assessment of investment risk and how objectives are returned, objectives met relating to the liabilities. Let's face it, stochastic modelling technology has really been around since the 1980s. I know I was using it in the 1980s, and we're now 30 years on, not 40 years on. And there's no excuse, I think, for failing to use it these days. So that was my first point. The second point in this space is that we should avoid being cheerleaders for product providers. Now, in our industry, it's the product providers that tend to have the resources to hire the most innovative thinkers, a lot of smart actuaries. Most of the superannuation funds that are out there, not all, there's a few that have got some good innovative people in them thinking, but most of them are looking to the product providers to, first of all, tell them what their issues are and then solve them. And that's a terrible situation, but that is the reality. And it means that solutions that to these issues are often packaged as investment products. And investment products must be designed, because I've done it myself, with a pretty narrow scope. You've got to define an investment product in a very specific way. Now, what that means is that for some problems, such as a retirement income problem that superannuation funds and their members are facing into, if you are defining and if you're looking for the solution in terms of the product, you won't actually cover all of the issue. Now, product providers also see this retirement income problem as an opportunity, and they're industriously going about creating products to solve it. And to achieve their success, they do what all investment product providers have always done. They play on one or more of the triad of emotions, hope, fear, or greed. In this case, it's fear. So we had the GFC, and I've seen so many things talked about the GFC that says, would you want your balance at retirement to go down by as much as balances at retirement went down in the GFC? And then we have this sort of thinking, this whole notion of sequencing risk coming up. And most of the discussion about sequencing risk, in my view, is shrill. It's self-perpetuating. There's nothing will create sequencing risk more than if you require members to crystallise out of one type of investment strategy and buy into another investment strategy at retirement. And that's exactly what is being done when you have product providers that are coming up with solutions, is they're selling products. You're creating a situation where the member is buying and selling, forced to buy and sell at prevailing prices, different things. And that's not a good thing to do. And this is especially a case for annuities. And this is where I think the Institute has really become a cheerleader for product providers, because they seem to spend all their time talking about annuities and not thinking more broadly. Annuities, if interest rates are low at retirement, which we have at the moment, then annuities will be a very expensive way to solve some of these retirement income issues that they have. Now, I understand that actuaries working for annuity providers will rightly promote the benefits, and there are a lot of benefits in annuities, and that's fair enough, but it doesn't mean that the Institute should. Which leads me to my third point about this low interest rate environment. On the subject of annuities, there seems to be an emerging call, and I don't know whether it's come out today and tomorrow, but for some sort of forced annuitisation in retirement, the sort of crazy policy that the UK now thankfully has dumped. The fact is that most Australians already have an annuity, and it's by dint of their citizenship. It's called the age pension. And this is provided by an entity that doesn't price off the yield curve, doesn't charge margins to cover capital adequacy, doesn't charge margins to mitigate the uncertainty of mortality improvement, doesn't need to turn a profit, it has the power to tax, and it can share risk between generational cohorts, much like DB funds can. But it's better than this. The income as an assets test of act as really interesting natural buffers so that retirees with a modest amount of wealth can invest in a way that looks for growth and will be and have a natural hedge in terms of the age pension. Now, I'm not saying it's perfect. It's far from perfect. I would imagine it should start later. It should gradually increase with age, and even modestly well-funded retirees that wouldn't necessarily expect to be receiving the age pension should be fairly confident of getting a good outcome in their frail years. So there's lots of things that can be done, and I hopefully this week when we'll see some of these things in the budget, but probably not, but hopefully some of them. But what I'd hate to see is a requirement that retirees that are self-funded today should be, are forced into expensive, low-return products such as annuities. I haven't done the numbers, but I would expect that if retirees continue to be allowed to invest in high-growth but volatile investments during retirement, maybe in the first decade or so after retirement, none of this stuff about, you know, something special happens at retirement, it in fact doesn't. The only things that happen at retirement are you change your tax regime and your cash flows turn from being small, positive but small relative to your balance to negative but small relative to your balance. So there's nothing actually special, particularly special about the date of retirement. And if you look at it, the first decade or so after retirement, most retirees that are well funded actually are in a position to continue to invest significantly in growth assets, provided they can get a decent return on them. And that's another issue. But if we force annuitisation, then I would expect that will have a perverse result relative to the public purse, because most people will then be forced into annuities onto the age pension earlier. Anyway, I haven't seen a lot of debate about that, and I'd hope that this is the sort of thing that the Institute could be take some more leadership on. Anyway, here are my 3 points. The Institute's in a great position to take some leadership on these issues. It's tinkering at the edges, and I don't think it does so. It needs to embrace stochastic asset liability modelling. It can do it. It's got the skills to do it. It's what needs to be done, and it's 20 years after, you know, when the technology's been available. Why doesn't it? Partly through historical reasons, but also partly because I think a number of actuaries and the Institute, as a result the Institute, are captured by some of the product providers, maybe insidiously. They don't really, implicitly, if you like, they don't really realise it. And in a low interest rate environment, the whole system, I would imagine the whole system may be better off if retirees are encouraged to take appropriate risk, not overly conservative risk, leading up to and in their retirement. Don't let the product providers, you know, win this fear on this fear campaign. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everyone. When Alistair set this up, the idea was having Ian come up and speak about markets, and Ian's come up and said, look, looking forward, the opportunity for returns is reasonably low, and I would agree with that. Then Chris has stood up and said, but given we have the age pension, we should be encouraging retirees to invest in risky assets so that they can get a high return. Except the high return's not there because, as Ian said, there's a low return. And so then my piece was to say, Eureka, the solution is active management. That was the plan. I'm not sure it's going to work. Before I talk about active management, and it's not going to probably go into the direction that you're thinking of, I'd like to say why I think there's 3 things about being an actuary that we should take advantage of in the investment management industry that we're not. The first thing I would say is that time horizon is incredibly important. And when you've been brought up valuing life insurance companies, working out premiums for life insurance policies, which involve forecasts of mortality and returns and inflation over in 30 or 40 years, you actually have a very long time horizon. If you think about superannuation, I remember being told when I did my first triennial valuation of a superannuation fund, it's like steering an oil tanker through the ocean. You know, you just change it a little bit on the way through because it is a long time horizon. So I think actuaries, by their nature, have a long-term time horizon. Let's compare that to the investment management industry. Okay, so when I first started getting into investment management, probably 20 years ago, but more recently when I joined Lazard about 12 years ago, we used to look at the world and we used to complain about the focus of people on quarterly earnings. So when you're talking to companies and when stockbrokers or even a lot of fund managers, they focus on quarterly earnings of companies. And if you think about it, when we're building retirement and investment solutions with 30 or 40 time horizons, what does a quarterly return matter? But now look at where we are today. We've got high-frequency trading where share prices are moving in under a second. So I thought quarterly was bad. We're now less than a second and we should be out at 30 or 40 years. Okay? So what I think the key advantage actuaries have is we do have an ability to understand the long term, and it's frightening how few people have that. The second thing I'd like to say is I think we understand cash flow forecasting and present value calculations better than most people. So if I look at the investment management industry, when you're valuing a share, valuing a property, valuing infrastructure, it's the present value of future cash flows. But virtually everyone who is in the funds management industry or is CFA trained uses shortcuts. Okay, they value stocks on price to earnings ratios or dividend yields or cash flow yields. They use shortcuts because they don't really get how to do it the long way. And the thing about every actuary in this room is we've sat there with the piece of paper with year one, year two, year three, year four, put the number in, present valued it back to zero, and we know how to do it. So we actually understand a DCF. And there's very, very few people, quite surprisingly, in the funds management industry that actually do. And so they make mistakes. They get things wrong. The third thing that I think we get that most people don't is the power of compound interest. The actual massive impact that a reasonable rate of return makes on a capital value. And I was reading something last week that I thought I'd share with you. Everybody's heard the example of how the Dutch bought Manhattan from the local Indians. It was in 1626. Does anybody remember how much they paid? It was $24. Okay? And so everybody uses this as an example of how the white Dutch ripped off the Indians, and how, you know, wasn't that a horrible thing? It's colonization, and how bad was that? Has anybody worked out what $24 is, earning 8% per annum, which is not a huge thing if the Indians had invested in a reasonable returning asset for 388 years? Do you know what the answer is? It's $223 trillion. They could have bought back Manhattan and Tokyo and Sydney and London, and actually they could have bought back the whole world. That type of concept that everybody in the room here kind of knows and wouldn't have been surprised with the answer, most of the investment world has no concept about. So they're my opening three comments. That's what I think actuaries have that most other people don't. Now let's talk about active management for the moment. Active management has two levels. I'm going to start with the first one. Active management at the stock selection or bond selection level is where you take different positions from an index. The big debate in the world in active management is, can active managers add value after fees compared to passive management, which is just buying either a market cap benchmark or something like that. Now, what tickled my fancy on this one is, does anybody get the Ambex Share reports or Woody Brock? They pointed out something that's actually quite fascinating. Graham Farmer and Shiller received a Nobel Prize last year, and they shared that Nobel Prize. Now, most of you would have studied this, but briefly, Farmer presents logic and evidence in favour of market efficiencies and implies that it's impossible to beat markets. Shiller presents logic and evidence in favour of market inefficiency and implies that it is possible to beat the market. And these two guys shared the Nobel Prize. And I find that quite amusing because they were saying the exact opposite thing. Actuaries aren't here in this debate. I'm someone who sits there and says, if Ian's telling me we can only get 6 to 8%, and I, working for an active manager, can give you 2% more because I think the market's inefficient, that's important. And that's an important thing we should talk about. However, let's get back to time horizon. I worked at an investment management shop that's got an Australian equity product that's got 12 years of history. It's a good returning strategy. But what I've got is I've got the ability to look at the time-weighted rate of return from that product over 12 years, and then also the money-weighted. And when I say money-weighted, I look at when did clients put money in and when did they take money out. And despite all the years and all the expertise and all the advice that clients have taken, basically clients have put money in after the product has outperformed, and they've taken money out after the product has underperformed. And a beautiful 12-year track record of offering significant active management or active return above the benchmark has been almost completely wiped out by the timing of when people put money in and out. So that's another problem with this debate, is that the experience of a super fund or an investment or a multi-manager like MLC or an individual of active management depends on when they put their money in and money out, and we all keep doing that at the wrong time. Time horizon would help, because if you're not thinking that you have to look at the returns every quarter, every year, every 3 years, and you can let things sit, I think you would get a better result, and that's where I think actuaries can actually help. So I actually think we caused some of this problem because we did set up the benchmarks and we did set up the tables and the surveys and looking at things, but then what I think we can undo is by looking things over a longer time horizon and fiddling less. So that's the first thing on active management. The last thing I'd say on active management is the bigger opportunity in active management is the ability to move assets between asset classes. So moving money between bonds, between equities, between property and between infrastructure. Quite a lot of research was done on the fact that it's actually very difficult to move money between asset classes, and quite often the costs of moving it means that you lose any potential return. Where I think, again, the time horizon argument comes into this is that it's hard when a market is priced between one standard deviation expensive and one standard deviation cheap to time when to go in and go out. But if a market is two standard deviations expensive, you shouldn't be there. And as long as you've got a time horizon of 5 to 10 years, we can almost guarantee that that market will mean revert. The problem is if you've only got a time horizon of 1 to 3 years, you just don't know. So if you think about all the opportunities we have as professionals to get people into and out of markets when things are either two standard deviations expensive or two standard deviations cheap, quite often that gets ruined because the time horizons aren't long enough. So just to conclude, what I'd say is I think active management is important. I think the time horizon and the industry structures make it very, very difficult for people to accept active management at the stock selection level and also at the asset allocation level, because people are measured over 1 and 3 years, and quite often that's not long enough. And the reason I think the Institute can help is, A, I do think we as a group of people have more time horizon than other people do, and we do understand the impact of compound interest and the impact of cash flows and how to model them. So thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much. I might open up with one question, and I'm happy to hand it over to other people, or I can keep asking questions, but each of you spend probably a bit of your time or have spent a bit of your time with boards and investment committees, people who have to make these decisions. And I guess the sense I get from the discussions that each of you have had is that, you know, perspective, both from an analytical perspective, a markets perspective, and an evaluation perspective even, is really important. So my question for each of you is, how can actuaries be effective in terms of engaging with boards and investment committees on some of these decisions in terms of setting the right time horizons?
I think there's two sorts of boards that I've been involved with. A number of years ago when I was at MLC, it was a business board about investment product, and frankly I don't think as an actuary I've been particularly successful at all in getting their focus away from short time horizons that are very much to do with how you're doing against your competitors. So I don't know how to do that. I suspect Ian might have a better idea there. I think, though, with the trustee boards that we've got as an industry, a lot more ability to exercise that that perspective, because they are looking for guidance.
Yeah, there's no holy grail, is there, Chris? But I think the one thing that always resonates for me is the boards that operate well, or the ones that I've seen operate well, are boards who have a very clear sense of identity about their mission and what beliefs need to hold for them to achieve their mission. And that's almost independent of what role they take on, trustee, corporate board, etc. Once you have that as a precondition, as an actuary or any other advisor, understanding that is crucial to getting on the right journey as a partner and being able to frame the issues in the context of what resonates with them to get the right decision. Now, it all sounds like, you know, motherhood and apple pie, but everything that's broken down, in my opinion, has been one of two things. Either the board has no mission and flip-flops all over the show. You can't give advice, in my opinion, in that scenario, or constructive advice. And the second area in which it breaks down is when there's an extreme disconnect between the advisor's view of the world and the board's view of the world. And you have that discontinuity and you're swimming against the tide again. So there's got to be clear vision and there's got to be congruence, in my view.
Any questions? All right, I'm happy to follow up with another one. Sorry. Jump up.
Chris, you touched on the regulators and some of the things that the regulators do or don't do. And an interesting one for me was after the standard risk measure came out, they came out with a survey, one of the survey providers, of all the superannuation options with that same standard risk measure. So you have the same standard risk measure, we're comparing, you know, options with the same risk. But they also said what allocation growth defensive assets they had, and they, some were 100% equity, some were 100% cash, and apparently they're the same risk because they're different underlying assumptions. Do you think the regulators are a massive hindrance, both in respect of the running cost of the system, an inhibitor to innovation, and assisting retirees actually understanding the system better?
Absolutely, yes, yes. I mean, as another example, this requirement to under Strong Super to disclose all your investments, the only people that benefits are the, in my view, is the superannuation fund's competitors, because they you know, particularly for a large fund, because they know what you've got, and if they know what you've got, they know what you're likely to do, and they just they'll get in front of you. But more importantly, it focuses on the wrong thing. Once again, it's a focus back on the balance. We've got the superannuation balance, and that is not what we should be focusing on. We should be focusing on what retirement income is going to be generated from your involvement with this superannuation fund. And the balance gets in the way. In my view, I've got no problems. It's DC. You've got to report the balance. But let's keep that towards the back. Let's have up in the front here, this is your expected retirement income. So, Well, I have some sympathy for that, but the statutory basis must be more sophisticated and incorporate investment risk. The regulator gets concerned that that funds are going to use retirement income estimates as a competitive tool, and I think that concern is probably misfounded. What it really should be is how can they. It should be focusing on the members they have. The members aren't out there shopping between superannuation... I don't think they will either. Shop between superannuation funds based on their retirement income estimate. It's a reporting thing, it's a planning thing, it's an advice thing. And it's between the fund and the member.
If you think about who's influencing the regulators and who has the money and the resources to respond to queries and things like that, it is the big product providers. And I think that's why you end up with the results that you do. So I don't think it's because the regulator themselves is particularly poor or good. It's just that the feedback that it gets from industry leads it to where it goes. And so if you're looking at why people came out with that 1 year in seven, it's an easy thing to put on a product and it's an easy thing for a product provider to do. If the Institute was a stronger voice and could, A, either get some of the product providers on side and be an alternative voice to the regulator, I think the regulator would come to the right decision. But I think we're reasonably silent and they're not the product providers.
Sometimes complicit.
We've got time for one or two more questions. Russell.
You mentioned that actuaries would be good at helping with asset allocation, but what we've seen over, I suppose, the last 10 to 20 years is a move to most funds and investors using specialised asset managers for different sectors. How do you think we can move back to a situation where, you know, where investors would actually give their money to a single asset manager across different asset classes to make those decisions?
There's probably the biggest trend in investment management today, and that's not just here but also globally, is the move to what are called multi-asset portfolios. And so what people are doing is they're giving, say, 10% of their portfolio to a single manager who then builds multi-asset portfolios, which sounds to me like an old-fashioned balance fund, and I think it actually probably is. So I was talking to Chris about this earlier. My view of the world is it just is ever repeating cycles that we go one way and then we go another. So I actually think we are moving back towards multi-asset portfolios and solutions. They won't go with one manager, but they're putting buckets of their money with someone who will make those sort of calls, and I do think that's sensible. When we moved from balance funds to specialist funds, we did so and stopped having the view that asset allocation was important, and so we had a static asset allocation and we did all the work on picking active managers. I think that's been proven to be not what people want, and the fact that in our superannuation industry a third of the people in the country have opted out and set up their own self-managed super fund kind of says we didn't do what people wanted. And so I think moving back to saying if you're investing money, you should think about the price that you're paying for things, and if they're expensive, you shouldn't be buying them, and if they are cheap, you should be buying them. And I think actuaries have, as I said, the time horizon to be able to know when things are expensive and cheap, and hopefully the time horizon to wait for them to come through. But I actually go back to Ian's comment. One of the best things I ever heard from an asset consultant was that the chain breaks at the weakest link, and so it's all very well having a board with a good vision, an asset consultant who works well with that division, an internal investment team that works well in that with that vision as well. If there's one person in that chain that loses the vision or changes, that's where the chain will break, and that's where all the thoughtfulness will go, and that's where you lose a lot of money. So it's not easy to do, and we're all human. It makes it hard.
I think the two challenges which have nothing to do with actuaries, Russell, in the context of those multi-asset funds. One is the hyper-competitive environment that every investor, large investor, finds itself in that they're always looking at the tables, the league tables, and being too different to the herd is problematic in the multi-asset funds. If invested in any great measure, will put them at a point of difference to the herd. The more people who get comfortable with outcomes-based investing and are willing to distance themselves from quarterly surveys or whatever, I think the more success we'll have with the multi-asset funds. The second thing is, how do you judge success? And in all the conversations that I've been involved in, that is the single largest obstacle. It's easy to judge an equity manager against the market benchmark. It's easy to judge a property manager against the aggregate of its peers. How do you judge other than over the very long term? And it comes back to taking a long-term focus. How do you judge the success of those portfolios? That's where investment committees get stuck. Less so internal teams who can look under the hood and can look for other proof points, but boards and investment committees struggle with that. How do I test it?
So I might just close with one final question. About 2 years ago, the Institute had a forum which the Wealth Management Committee set up, which was in relation to short-termism. And it seemed at that time, and Chris and I were both panel members in this discussion, that short-termism was at its highest point, almost. And I'm wondering whether any or all of you have any perspectives about where we're at in that cycle of short-termism. Is it getting better or is it getting worse?
My view, Alistair, is we're at a very interesting point where it could go one way or the other. And the reason, and I think I'm biased to less short-termism. The launch of all the life cycle options, the move of QSuper to mass customized outcome-based investing or whatever they like to call it, all of that has started to shift the focus away from just the league table. And that, I think, is going to work against short-termism. There will be this very clear distinction between those investment options in super funds that are positioned to compete with a particular peer group, and there will be a whole swag of others that are focused on outcomes or whatever you want to call it, and for whom about which the discussion of longer term horizons will become very real and hopefully become more meaningful. So I think we're at that tipping point. If any of those fail early, we'll tip back the other way. And that'll be the real test. It's holding the course. If they lag, fail, I mean by all means, all different means. They could fail simply because markets are strong and they've taken a lower risk weighting and risk assets.
I agree with a lot of that, but the other prism I'd put on it is that we've just come through 2013, and 2013 was if you were in growth assets, you did really well. So people probably are thinking, well, you know, we don't want to be short term because we need to be in growth assets because otherwise we'll miss out. And I think that will that will certainly wane when we have another market crisis.
The one thing that really worried me is that in this crisis, and I've been through a few in my career, this is the first time that the short-termism actually has ended up at the company level as well. So for the first time in our experience, we have, you know, most of the big companies around the world come into our head office and talk to us. And in the last couple of years, one of the questions that we keep getting asked by company management is, what do you want us to do with the cash? Do you want us to give it back to you in dividends or do you want us to do buybacks? So if you think about that, that is the people who generate economic growth are asking us what do we want them to do with the money. Now, what we want them to do with the money is to invest and to invest in things that are going to make us more money in the future. Yet most of them are now so focused on increasing their dividends or giving us buybacks so that all the institutional investors have good cash return and high income, that they're actually not investing. And I think Ian started by saying the earnings growth just isn't there. So the one thing that concerns me is that the short-termism has penetrated down to the level of company management, which hasn't happened before. And unless that gets solved, then we don't have any economic growth and we've got a lot bigger problems than we've got at the moment. That said, I'm actually hopeful. I actually agree with Ian. I hope that we're at the bottom of the timing and things do get pushed out a little bit further.
All right, well, I think we've got to wrap it up there. I think my key takeaway is we all need a change of apparel. And by that, I think Ian was suggesting we might need a hard hat for the upcoming markets. Chris says we need to remove our cheerleader's skirt. And I think we all need a set of glasses to look a bit further forward, as Susan was indicating. So, look, thanks very much for coming, and hopefully you enjoyed the session. And also feel free to rate the session, and there's a small gift for the presenters here.